Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. Joining me today is Bruce Perny. Bruce, how are you doing today?
Just great. Thanks, Rob.
Great. Well, I'm glad that you're on the show with us. We have an exciting show today. Bruce, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you've done?
Well, I live in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I'm an expat because I'm originally from Vermont. And I was fortunate enough to come up to Canada and do some coaching and had the opportunity to become a Canadian citizen and represent the country in several Olympic Games.
Very impressive. And what did you compete in?
I'm a shot putter, or was a shot putter.
Shot putter. So how'd you get into that?
Well, I went to I was in Springfield High School, and my grades weren't the best, and my father decided that I needed to go to summer school, so they sent me to Phillips Andover Academy. And at Andover, you had to participate in a sport. Mm-hmm. They didn't have physical education, so I, being the largest person in the school in the summer session, they encouraged me to go out for shot, and that's where I got my first taste of it, and I never really looked back.
And so how old were you when you moved to Canada then?
It was after I graduated from university and spent a year of graduate school, so I was probably 22, I think,
22, wow.
Something around there.
Wow. And did you compete in college then here in the States?
I went to Yankton College in Yankton, South Dakota, which was a long way from Springfield, Vermont. And I went sight unseen and competed there. And it was a small liberal arts college and was able to I only threw 1 year in high school. So and I didn't play high school sports until I was in grade 12. So it gave me a chance to kind of learn on the fly, and being a small school, and they were quite happy to have myself. At that time, I was 6'7" and about 230 pounds. So they were kind of happy to have me around.
Absolutely. And do you come from a family that is generally larger?
My mother was almost 6 feet tall. And back in that day, that was my dad was 6'1". My dad was an oarsman, rode for Harvard, and my mother was quite an accomplished athlete, although not so much competitively. She did a little diving when she was young.
Very nice. And as far as the type of background that you came from, was your family working class, or how was that?
Definitely working class. My dad went to Harvard. I actually come from a family of – I'm the black sheep of the family. I went to Yankton in South Dakota. Everybody else went to Harvard. But my family was citizen soldiers, and my dad was – I was born during World War II, and my dad was overseas. And – so my family's kind of a military background, very typically U.S. People worked, but they also fought.
Sure, sure. And so in terms of how you ended up in shot put, like what drew you to that, aside from all the other things that a man of your size could have done?
I think it was the challenge of, trying to – the one thing about the shot or the individual events is, it's you against everything else, and you can't, you don't rely on anybody else. If you are successful, it's because of the work that you put in, and it's hopefully a little bit of innate talent. And but it's you against, against everybody else. And it was also something that I could work on my own, which I did from time to time throughout my career.
Sure.
But it's a great, obviously it's a challenge, and, every day you're trying to do a little bit better, and I like that.
Sure. So what, I'm not sure if I missed it, but what led you then to move to Canada?
Well, that's a really interesting story. I was going to summer school, and I looked at the bulletin board in the gymnasium, and there was a poster from a track and field camp in Canada at the International Peace Garden, which borders North Dakota and the province of Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of at odd ends after summer school, so I wrote him a letter and said, "Hey, listen, you know." And I thought I was pretty hot stuff, you know, being a shot putter at a you know, small college. But you know, I said, you know, asked them if they were looking for anybody, any counselors, et cetera. Well, to make a long story short, they said no. They had their staff, but if I wanted to come up and demonstrate, they would, you know, put me up and you know, provide meals, et cetera. So I hopped in my green Volkswagen, headed north. Which, because Yankton is right in the southeast tip of South Dakota, drove, it seemed like, forever,
right,
straight north through the fields, and ended up in the International Peace Garden, and met a lot of really terrific people there. And 2 years later, when I was finishing graduate school,
mm-hmm.
and not really wanting to go, to write my thesis, they offered me a job, a teaching job in Winnipeg, and I jumped at it.
Very nice. Now, is that what you went to school for then, education?
Well, I have a history degree.
Okay.
I really didn't know what I was going to do with it. I picked up some education, and I swore that I, because I'm a very late developer, I wasn't very very good at physical education. You know, I hated phys ed classes. So I swore I'd never be in physical education. Well, I ended up going to graduate school in physical education, and ended up, before I got through, as being a physical education administrator for one of the school divisions. So I guess that didn't work out quite the way I planned it.
But things always work out in a strange way, don't they?
They do. You never know where you're going to be when you graduate from university, that's for sure.
That's it. That's it. Now, getting back to your shot put career, tell us a little bit about how you, you know, you ended up competing in very high profile competitions such as the Olympics and the, we'll start with the Olympics.
Well, I threw in college. I wasn't particularly good. You know, I could compete at that level.
Sure.
Came to Canada, and a friend, or gentleman, an elderly, not elderly, but an older gentleman. I went by the track one day and started talking with me, and I decided that I would throw that summer. And, of course, I had met people through the track camp and had taught throwing there. Anyway, to make a long story short, he said, "Well, listen, do you want to go to Nationals?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd love to." And so I ended up hopping on a train from Winnipeg going to Edmonton, Alberta, which in those days, that was a long train ride.
Right.
Competed in the national championships there. And I didn't do particularly well, but I got hooked. And that's really where I, you know, how I renewed my career.
Right. And how old were you at this point?
I was in my early 20s.
Okay.
Just fresh out, or just about to start my first teaching job. So things progressed not very rapidly, but I managed to be, I was competitive up there. And one summer, I went west, and I ran into the first of two Hungarian coaches that really influenced me. And they gave me some tips on some things, which because there wasn't any coaching in Manitoba, and I had an improvement and sort of rededicated myself, and I ended up moving. I moved out to the province of Saskatchewan, which is the next province over, into a little community. And worked with a former Hungarian international coach named Gábor Simony, who is very well known in North America as a hammer coach. And he took my shot, and we broke it down. And in 2 years, I went from being competitive to being capable of making a national team.
Wow. So what was the training like at that point? You know, how many hours a day were you working with your coaches?
Probably. Well, I worked with Gabor one-on-one, which is a phenomenal opportunity. And we probably had just the two of us, five sessions, technical sessions a week. And then, of course, we did the weight training, et cetera. So probably you're talking about 10 workouts a week at that point,
right,
which nowadays isn't a lot because most of the athletes are professionals, you know,
sure,
at this level. But I was teaching at the time as well. So, I was sandwiching my weight training, and I was married at the time, and then my
right,
coaching and all of that. But that worked out because it was a one-on-one situation.
Wow. And it does sound like you were definitely balancing a lot at the same time just to get there.
Oh, yeah. We're juggling balls in the air for sure.
And so how fast did you progress then and eventually get the opportunity to compete in the Olympics?
Well, I went to Canada originally in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved to Saskatchewan. I believe it was in 69, and I made the 1972 Olympic Games. So I spent my 2 years with Gabor were really pretty special.
Right.
And then I spent 1 year. I spent a year just prior to the Olympic Games at the University of Saskatchewan, which is in Saskatoon. And I went there as a graduate student. That lasted about 6 weeks. I realized I had no ability with a computer. In those days, it was all cards and things like that. So I just knuckled down and trained, and lo and behold, I had a big breakthrough that year and ended up winning the national championships and Olympic trials in 1972.
Wow, that's incredible. And so you were in 1972, and you also competed in the 76 Olympics, right?
That's correct, yes.
Wow. Now, I have to ask because obviously, 1972 in Munich was somewhat of an extraordinary time with the terror attacks. How was that
absolutely
for you to deal with that? I mean, what was that like?
It was a situation that nobody could comprehend. Our village was right on the perimeter, and there was one building in between us, and then there was Kommelstrasse, which is where the attacks occurred.
Yeah.
We got up that morning, and I looked out of my two story of my sec- we were on second story on a balcony, and there was a German soldier in a coal shovel helmet in a red Puma suit with a submachine gun. And that was before we had started to compete yet.
Mm-hmm.
We were locked down basically for the whole day, and only thing we knew was what was going on the Armed Forces radio.
Sure.
And so that night we could hear all the helicopters and we could from the corner of my building, because we had no idea what terrorism was at that time.
Right. Yeah.
In the corner of my building, I could see right underneath the Israeli building, and I could see action, things going on. And I mean, I could have been shot from there. I mean, they had a direct line of fire. I never even thought about it,
Sure.
And in any case, we saw the buses leave, and we heard the helicopters and all that. And then we thought it was all taken care of. And the next morning I got up and I walked down to the main floor, and our chef de mission was there, and he had been up all night, and he just was wandering around saying, "They're all dead, they're all dead, they're
yeah.
all dead." So it was a tremendously traumatic experience for all
Absolutely.
Of us.
And, I mean, did it take away from the excitement that you were feeling, that being your first Olympics?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Up to that point, we had already been in Germany for a month, and we had traveled around and competed in a number of warm-up meets and had done very well. And, you know, it was a phenomenal experience. Munich is a wonderful city. And, you know, we were just, you know, just it was great. And all of a sudden this happened. And, of course, the IOC, it's no secret, they had no clue how to deal with this. I mean, nobody did.
Right. Right.
And we had several Jewish people on our team, including my co-captain, Abigail Hoffman, who hadn't run yet. And Abby was really struggling with whether she was going to compete or not. And, you know, it was just a horrific, horrific experience.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, and like you said, too, it's something that at that time was not so prevalent in society, but now, obviously, for us, these modern times, unfortunately, it's almost, you know, kind of expected that something can happen, you know, at any time there.
Absolutely. But, you know, it was interesting. There was the German people were terrific. They were trying so hard to, you know, to be part of the international sport experience. And when we were one of the first teams in the village, and my roommate and I, who is a discus thrower from Ontario,
right.
He and I got up early in the morning. We just walked out of the village, walked across the you know, the colonnade. There was no security there. Walked into the Olympic Stadium, literally walked in there, and we're sitting there watching the sun come up. You know, and
yeah.
Now, of course, nothing could possibly happen like that.
Right. Yes, I mean, it's sad to hear something like that, you know. Really, all the hard work that you must have put in, and that any person that's getting to the Olympics, because that is the goal for so many people out there that are involved in these, you know, these competitions, and, you know, to have something like that happen, I mean, it's got to be just a harrowing experience. I mean, and for you to say, too, it's something that you could see directly going on in front of you.
Yeah, it was, but it was incomprehensible at that time. You know, we really, you know, we didn't have anything to base our reaction on. You know, there was
right.
nothing. So it wasn't until later. It was interesting because athletes at a high level have the ability to block things out.
Right.
You have to be able to. You have to be able
sure.
to. Focus is so important. And I hadn't competed yet. So 3 days later, Brian Oldfield and I and the other American throwers, you know, we're in the preliminary rounds of the Olympics.
Right.
And so you block everything out. And and life goes on.
Right.
The thing that was really scary for me was that 3 or 4 years later, as we're preparing for the 1976 games, obviously the media is bringing this back up.
Sure.
And I had built walls and barriers with this, you know, so that I didn't think about it. I didn't realize it at the time, but they showed, I think it was probably Bud Greenspan, you know, that did such marvelous work with, you know, the documentaries at the time. All of a sudden, this comes up a year before the Olympic Games, and all my barriers went crashing down, and I actually was in tears, and I
sure.
just, you know, I just could not function for several days. It was just, I'd walled everything off, all this emotion off. So it was pretty, you know, it's very personal, obviously, and everybody
right.
reacts to things like that in different ways, but that was the first time, and nobody really understood it.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, it is one of those experiences that you can't really put to words, because you're first of all overexcited by the opportunity that is in front of you, and then to have
Absolutely.
Something like that occur. Now, in terms of getting yourself into the mindset then of getting into competing and what you have to do, how did you kind of how would you say as an athlete you personally are able to block things out?
Everybody has their own little tricks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I used to do a lot of – I used to read a lot. We didn't have, you know, earphones and music. We had little tape recorders in those days originally. you know, but I always had my own music that I was really comfortable with. And I always, and I got into science fiction and I got into Westerns around that time. And the interesting thing about it, and it's obviously when you, I never really thought about it till later, but it's total role playing. Because when you buy a Zane Grey Western, for example, or Louis L'Amour Western, what happens? Well, you know, the guy comes into rides into town. You know, he's the stranger. You know, he's up against all these odds, and you know, by the time he's over, you know, he's killed the bad guys. You know, he's won the day, and he rides off into the sunset. Well, you know, when I started psychoanalyzing myself later in my career, it was pretty obviously what I was doing. You know, I was creating this underdog situation for myself, you know, being the lone Canadian, you know, you know, in this world. But it was interesting, and it worked. You know, I was able to, for whatever reason, that persona seemed to work for me.
Absolutely. Now, who were some of your personal heroes as far as, you know, I mean, whether it be athletes or any other figure?
Well, I really think I have to go back to my family first and foremost. My father was a Olympic class oarsman who ended up obviously going to war in World War II, so he never did get a chance to do that, but he was bigger than life, and I come from a family of citizen soldiers, so that was you know, he was a very major influence on my life, and later on I subconsciously I think I patterned a lot of my leadership style after some of the things that he did. But I had terrific coaches in college, not great technical coaches, but people that really had that were very, well, we would say now humanistic or holistic, you know, they kept things in context. And then a couple of Gábor Simonyi and George Gamer, my Hungarian coaches, they were all really important to me as well. So those people provided me with a lot of, you know, strength, but also good examples as to what to do and how to handle myself. So those are probably, you know, a couple of people. I moved away from home when I was 17. I went out west, and I really never spent a lot of time back after that. So I was out, you know, in a little boy in South Dakota, you know.
Right, right. So your family did stay then over here in the U.S.?
Oh, yes, yeah. I have one younger brother still alive. My parents are unfortunately, they've deceased. But, yeah, my family's was still based in, they stayed in Vermont, and my father was managed a machine tool company. So that's where they were.
Right. And so getting back to Munich then, how did you place with the competition, you know, within that competition, and you know, what do you think you could have done differently or better? I mean, is there some things that you kind of regret about your performances there or anything like that?
Yeah, actually, I was very well prepared. In those days, we didn't have a lot of personal coaching at the games,
mm-hmm.
and so I was pretty well on my own. I did some coaching actually myself because I had coached all the way through there. So I was working with a couple of the combined event athletes, but I was ready, and I knew that I competed at 10:30 in the morning. That was where I had to qualify.
Right.
And so I planned for the month before that. I got up, I had breakfast 4 hours before, and I trained at 10:30 in the morning. So I, when it came to, you know, the qualifying round, the way qualifying rounds work, you get three throws,
mm-hmm.
and you either have to make whatever the qualifying standard is, or you have to finish in the top 12 in order to move on. Well, at that time, the qualifying standard was not high enough, and we ended up with, I think, 16 people in the final. But I was the first thrower in my group. Mm-hmm. There were two groups, and on my first throw, I decided, well, I'm going to go in there. I'm going to take an easy throw, make sure I'm set, and then I'm going to go for it in my second throw. So my first throw, I made the qualifying standard. Great. terrific. So now I'm really pumped because, you know,
right.
it was easy and I was ready to go. And the official said, no, you're finished. You've made the qualifying standard. Well, nobody on the Canadian team had told me that I didn't get three throws. So I was really. So anyway, so all my preparation was designed, you know, for that particular moment. Well, the two of us, Brian Oldfield, the famous American shot putter, and I, we were the only people in the first round that qualified out of our group. So we went back and they took us off the field. And we stood in the tunnel and we watched the rest of the qualifying.
Right.
And then the next day, the finals, I couldn't get up at all. I just psychologically, my whole everything was based had been based on that first 10:30 in the morning effort. So
right.
I finished 15th. I qualified 13th, and I was okay with that. I wasn't happy, but
right.
you know, it was my first shot, so I thought it was all right.
Of course, yeah. I mean, so you know, with that result, then did you think I have to get back to the next Olympics? Is this going to happen? Is this what I'm going to be focused on for the next couple of years?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We came home. Unfortunately, we didn't have any support in those days, you know, for athletes.
Right.
And my wife and I, who was a national caliber hurdler at the time, we scrambled around trying to survive. And ended up moving back from Saskatchewan to Winnipeg because that's where her family was. Declared personal bankruptcy because nobody would give us a job.
Right.
couldn't get a job. And but even then, you know, I got a teaching job, came back, and we aimed for the next Olympic Games, which of course were going to be held in Montreal. You know, so you got a
yep.
home Olympics. So that went right back into it, and there is a cycle of competitions, particularly at that time, that lead up to the Olympic Games in Canada. That includes the British Commonwealth Games, or what's now known as the Commonwealth Games, the Pan American Games, and then the Olympic Games. We didn't have world championships in those days. So we had basically had a year to move back to Winnipeg and kind of get, you know, our feet back underneath us, right into Commonwealth Games, which were in New Zealand. And so went to the Commonwealth, and so that everything, the cycle started again, and we
yep.
worked really, really hard at it, trained hard, and was successful. I won the Pan American Games in Mexico City, as a lead up the year before, and I was flying pretty high.
That's great.
Be good. Unfortunately, I got hurt in training, overtrained. Never really recovered the whole last year. I did make it I did qualify to go to Montreal and competed. I was the captain of the Canadian team. But I shouldn't say competed. I was a shadow. I was a participant, and that was pretty tough
mm-hmm. sure.
at home. You know.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's like you said, you're training for this you're dedicating your time to the years that it takes to get there. And then to have that occur, and again, it probably goes back to some of the regrets you might have as far as overtraining or, you know, just not having the mindset at that moment that you needed, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was always, you know, a year out, you know, being successful, winning mm-hmm. the Pan American Games against some good world-class throwers from the United States. The mindset was, I'm going to, you know, to make the finals.
Right.
You know, I was teaching at the time because I had to make a living.
Sure.
And I took we were on a trimester system, and I took the third trimester off, so I went up and trained. And unfortunately, I had a weightlifting episode where I strained the rotator cuff in my shoulder. Never did fully recover. We went to California, did all the preliminary meets there, made the Olympic standard okay, but I wasn't able to maintain my strength. And at that time, I was, you know, 6'7", 300 pounds. But I couldn't maintain my pro body strength. So then you start trying to find ways, you know, you start fiddling. You work with your technique. You try to adapt this, and something else goes wrong, you know. And it was kind of a downhill spiral. It was a rather frustrating time. Great
sure.
to have the Olympic Games in Canada. I would have gone anyway, but it was very, very difficult afterwards.
Of course. Well, Bruce, I do want to let you know we are running out of time for this episode, but I'm glad to say that we do have you coming back next week to finish up this conversation. I want to thank you for coming on today. And again, like
thoroughly.
I said, again, like I said, we're going to have you back next week at the same day next week. So for everybody here at CMC Radio, I want to thank Bruce Perny for coming on. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you soon. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.